Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said the talks on Iran over Tehran's nuclear program are not open-ended. And if difficult decisions are not made, negotiators are ready to end the process.
And the simple fact is that despite all of the progress that we have made, and it's real, some of the tough issues remain unresolved. We know that difficult decisions don't become easier over time. In one way or the other, those decisions must be taken very soon.
The International Monetary Fund trimmed its 2015 global economic forecast Thursday, saying the main culprit was weaker growth in the United States, the world's largest economy. The IMF is predicting 3.3% growth across the world this year, down from its 3.5% prediction in April. With foul winter weather in early 2015, the American economy contracted 0.2% in the first quarter, and the IMF has cut its U.S. growth forecast for the year to 2.5%, just slightly above the 2014 figure. But the Washington-based agency is projecting 3% growth in the United States in 2016, with global growth accelerating to 3.8%. And the IMF research chief, Olivier Blanchard, downplayed the effect of the Greek debt crisis and Athens' bid for a new bailout to keep from being ousted from Europe's 19-nation euro currency bloc. Again, the International Monetary Fund trimmed its 2015 global economic forecast Thursday. This is VOA News. Leaders of the five BRICS nations have announced the launch of a development bank and a currency reserve pool intended to be an alternative to world financial institutions like the International Monetary Fund and World Bank. The BRICS meeting, which was held in the Russian city of Ufa and attended by the leaders of the group's five member states, was a chance for Moscow to show that it has friends and allies, despite being under Western economic sanctions for annexing Crimea and backing separatists in eastern Ukraine. The United Nations has announced that a humanitarian pause will begin in Yemen on Friday, providing a break in Saudi-led airstrikes and fighting with a Houthi militia that will allow aid to reach millions of Yemenis around the country. The unconditional humanitarian pause will continue until the end of Ramadan, UN spokesman Stefan Dzarek said. Eid, which marks the end of a month of fasting for Muslims, is scheduled for around July 17th. Nigeria's military says it has arrested a suspect believed to have been the main planner of bombings that killed more than 70 people in the cities of Jos and Zaria this week. The military made the announcement late Wednesday. Army spokesman Colonel Sani Usman said the arrest was made at a checkpoint in Gombe State as a result of a tip-off. He said the suspect, who was not named, was arrested along with two others. South Sudan is marking its fourth independence anniversary Thursday, but there is little to celebrate as citizens suffer from an ongoing civil conflict and a deepening humanitarian crisis. VOA's Gabe Joselo reports the international community has laid the blame on the country's rival political leaders.
In a recorded message to the South Sudanese people, U.S. National Security Advisor Susan Rice said it breaks her heart to see what South Sudan has become. She blamed the country's leaders.
President Kiir and Riek Machar and their cronies are personally responsible for this new war and self-inflicted disaster. And only leaders on both sides can end this violence.
The two sides have been engaged in lengthy peace negotiations mediated by the East African Regional Bloc, IGAD, but have failed to produce a lasting deal. The rival factions blame each other for stalling the process, which has been hung up mostly on a proposed power-sharing agreement and the reunification of the armed forces. Gabe Joselo, VOA News, Nairobi.
Lawmakers in South Carolina's House of Representatives have approved a measure to remove the Civil War-era Confederate flag from the grounds of the state capitol in Columbia. The bill passed early Thursday morning by a vote of 94-20 on its third and final reading, after more than 13 hours of contentious debate. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Ihis Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
South Sudan is marking its fourth independence anniversary Thursday, but there is little to celebrate as citizens suffer from an ongoing civil conflict and a deepening humanitarian crisis. The international community has laid the blame on the country's rivaling political leaders.
That's VOA's Gabe Joslow reporting. Details next.
Also in Nigeria, Reuters reports a bomb has exploded near the Federal High Court in Port Harcourt, and thousands of migrants and refugees are reported stranded at the border between Greece and Macedonia.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Liberia, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, South Sudan is marking its fourth independence anniversary today, but there is little to celebrate as citizens suffer from an ongoing civil conflict and a deepening humanitarian crisis. VOA's Gabe Joslow reports the international community has laid the blame on the country's rival political leaders.
South Sudanese civilians have paid the greatest cost for the war that began in December 2013, when a political fallout between President Salva Kiir and his rival, former Vice President Riek Machar, spiraled into inter-ethnic violence. Since then, tens of thousands have been killed, more than 2 million have been displaced, and millions more are facing food insecurity. Policy analyst Niall Tietmamer of the Sud Institute in Juba says there are understandably mixed feelings on the occasion of the country's hard-fought independence from Sudan.
First, you know, the people, on the one hand, are happy to mark the fourth independence anniversary of South Sudan. And then on the other hand, they are worried about tomorrow because of the ongoing conflict.
South Sudan's economy, which is dependent on oil exports, has been hit hard by the conflict and the collapse of oil prices worldwide. Tietmamer says this is where the people in the capital feel the most immediate impact.
And to import goods, you need to get hard currency, the dollars. So this has made the living standard really hard for the people because the prices for the basic goods are skyrocketing.
Both sides have been accused of committing rights violations during the conflict, including the forced recruitment and sexual abuse of children. Some 150,000 people are taking refuge in UN compounds across the country. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said hope is in short supply in South Sudan. He called on President Kiir and Machar to prove their leadership by investing in a political solution. In a recorded message to the South Sudanese people, U.S. National Security Advisor Susan Rice said it breaks her heart to see what South Sudan has become. She blamed the country's leaders.
President Kiir and Riek Machar and their cronies are personally responsible for this new war and self-inflicted disaster. And only leaders on both sides can end this violence.
The two sides have been engaged in lengthy peace negotiations mediated by the East African Regional Bloc, IGAD, but have failed to produce a lasting deal. The rival factions blame each other for stalling the process, which has been hung up mostly on a proposed power-sharing agreement and the reunification of the armed forces. On Wednesday, President Kiir began a new 3-year term in office after lawmakers voted to extend his mandate. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Nairobi.
In Nigeria, Reuters reports a bomb has exploded near the Federal High Court in Port Harcourt. Governor Nisom Wiki said he believes the attack was meant to disrupt an expected court ruling on whether elections for certain local government officials were legal. The High Court, he said, has decided they were not. In other news, Nigerian troops have arrested the mastermind of bombings in the central cities of Jos and Zaria this week that killed at least 69 people. The defense ministry says the alleged terrorist and two others with him were arrested. One of them was shot trying to escape. Officials say the suspect was caught at a checkpoint in the north city of Gombe. Over 200 people died last week in attacks by the radical Islamic group Boko Haram. Observers say the group has focused its bombings in recent months on the center of the country.
Thousands of migrants and refugees are reported stranded at the border between Greece and Macedonia. Doctors Without Borders says these include many elderly or disabled people, women who are pregnant, and young children. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The medical aid group, also known as MSF, says the migrants and refugees are in shrubby forests near the Greek village of Idomeni. The vast majority have fled violence and conflict in Syria, Afghanistan, and Iraq. Some sub-Saharan Africans have also been taking the route through the Balkans to reach other parts of Europe. Constant Tyson is the MSF humanitarian affairs officer in Greece. She says the organization has medical teams in Idomeni.
We chose the place because we realized end of last year and beginning of this year that a lot of people who arrive in the Greek islands, coming from Turkey by sea or by land, cross Greece and try to cross into Macedonia. So they cross Greece by foot and they continue their journey onwards through the Balkans to try to reach their final destination, let's say in Western Europe.
Last week, MSF reported a huge increase in the number of migrants and refugees coming to the village. Tyson gives two reasons why.
The number of people arriving in the islands in Greece has increased tremendously over the past months, but also linked to the fact that the Macedonian police has reinforced its patrols on the border, so it's harder for people to leave Greece and to cross into Macedonia. So we went from seeing around 300 people every day in our consultations in May to now seeing 1,000, 1,500 people staying in the forest there at the border.
Medical personnel have treated many people in Idomeni for respiratory tract infections, skin infections, and gastrointestinal problems.
Also, one of the things we really see a lot at the borders are people with bleeding or wounded feet. And this is directly a result of the fact that they are not allowed to take public or private transportation in the north of Greece, close to the border with Macedonia. So they leave the second biggest town in Greece, which is Thessaloniki in the north. And from there onwards, they have to walk for 2 days to reach the border.
It's a 64-kilometer trek from Thessaloniki to Idomeni. MSF is providing psychological support as well. Tyson says people have become more agitated and frustrated as Macedonia increases its police presence at the border. Some migrants and refugees say they have been pushed and shouted at by police. Shots have also been fired in the air to frighten people away from the border. While migrants and refugees have gathered in the forest around the Greek village, Tyson says there's little for them there.
Staying in the forest, there's nothing in terms of shelter, so they really sleep outside, whatever the weather. And there's no provision of food that's organized except some solidarity networks from the neighboring villages organizing from time to time food distributions, clothes distributions, and so on.
Doctors Without Borders is adding to that with blankets, energy bars, hygiene kits, and water stations. MSF also has medical teams in Serbia. Those that make it that far often have scabies and lice. The group's project manager in Idomeni, Antonis Rigas, says it's absurd how people who are fleeing war and violence are forced to risk their lives in countries that are able to ensure their protection. The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, reports that more than 4 million people have now fled the Syrian conflict. It's the world's single largest refugee crisis. Many of the Syrian refugees are in Turkey, and thousands of them are now heading for the Balkans. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
A
Mihis Wuhiben at 15 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. South Sudan is marking its fourth independence anniversary today, but there is little to celebrate. In Nigeria, Reuters reports a bomb has exploded near the Federal High Court in Port Harcourt. And thousands of migrants and refugees are reported stranded at the border between Greece and Macedonia. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237. The International Ebola Recovery Conference gets underway tomorrow at United Nations headquarters in New York. Member states will decide how much money is needed to rebuild the healthcare systems in Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone. Today, the conference is preceded by technical consultations on what the recovery process will be and how it will be implemented. Today's discussions are being chaired by Helen Clark, administrator of the UN Development Program. She opened the meeting with a reminder of the current state of the Ebola outbreak.
The recent new cases in Liberia and ongoing new cases in Sierra Leone and Guinea remind us that the battle against Ebola hasn't been won yet, and also underlines the urgent need to scale up national, regional, and global capacity for public health surveillance and emergency management. While getting to zero and staying at zero will be central to the sustained Ebola response, national governments rightly want to step up the focus on recovery and development. Decisive action now, under national leadership with generous international support, will help address the devastating social and economic impacts of Ebola and support the three countries to get firmly back on their development track.
Clark said decisions will be made tomorrow that will determine how long the impact of the Ebola epidemic will be felt.
We're all very aware of the devastating impact of Ebola on the people, communities, and institutions of Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. This impact will be felt for decades to come unless we all step up our support. The most direct impact was the tragic loss of life. The epidemic also halted the rapid growth rates all three countries had been experiencing. There's been a slowdown across the national economies from the agriculture sector, which accounts for a large share of GDP and livelihoods, through to construction, mining, and the service sectors. Many people lost their jobs and their livelihoods.
She said the economic slowdown and the need to divert resources to the Ebola fight adversely affected government budgets.
The outbreak has had a disproportionate impact on women, both in the numbers infected and deceased, and on the ability of the health systems to deliver essential services, such as for pregnancy and childbirth. But health services were affected across the board. We understand, for example, that HIV screening went down by around 90% in Sierra Leone.
Clark also said the Ebola outbreak disrupted traditions, triggered stigma and discrimination, and mistrust within communities.
To address the many challenges, each of the three countries and the Mano River Union have prepared the recovery strategies which are the basis for this conference. The strategies are complementary. The national strategies outline country-specific activities, while the Mano River Union plan focuses on sub-regional and cross-border issues. Together, the overarching objectives of the plans are to halt the epidemic and prevent future outbreaks, restore and strengthen capacity in public services, including health, restore livelihoods and build community and national resilience, and address structural factors which made containment of the disease difficult.
That's Helen Clark, administrator of the UN Development Program. Later this month, the African Union will hold a meeting in Equatorial Guinea to discuss how Africans can help each other with Ebola recovery and reconstruction. And as the UN plans to open its international conference on the disease tomorrow in New York, a just-released report by ONE found that during the Ebola crisis, the global community made aggressive public pledges of support. But it says keeping track of those pledges and monitoring their disbursement proved difficult. This is because of reporting processes and standards that are inconsistent, inefficient, and often not clear. I spoke to One's Global Health Policy Director, Aaron Hohlfelder, who says it's incredibly difficult to answer this question: how much have donors promised to this effort?
We really fundamentally believe that understanding how much money has been pledged and spent in a crisis is critical, not just as a sort of dry accounting exercise, but really as a matter of life and death in terms of understanding what the needs and the gaps are on the ground and programming more efficiently. So when we and many of our partners set out to start tracking, or at least trying to answer this very basic question, we were amazed by how difficult the challenge was. There's many efforts ongoing out there to track various types of aid flows, but there's so many different types of inputs. Donors are making various pledges, not just monetary pledges, but pledges of healthcare workers, pledges of in-kind supplies, and the picture just becomes really muddled and really complicated, and there's no one single place where all of that information is gathered and clarified and made sort of apples to apples across the board. So we just really can't get a clear picture.
Looking at the recent Ebola crisis in West Africa with the three hardest hit countries, Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, what did you find regarding those countries in terms of what they did right in tracking or what they needed to do?
I think they were obviously quite grateful for the support that was coming in, but also didn't necessarily feel in full control of their own country's response. There were so many international actors, streams of information, streams of resources flowing in, some of which were going to the government, but some which were going around the government. And I think it, again, sort of muddled the picture on the ground. It made it quite difficult to track those resources. And again, for the countries to really own the response and be able to say, here's what we have, here's what we need, and here's how we need others to step up and help.
So ultimately, is it up to the governments of these countries to ensure accountability for donations, whether it's money donations or human resource donations?
You know, ultimately, in a sort of modern crisis like the Ebola outbreak, I really think it takes a global effort. It's going to take goodwill from donors to be more transparent, not just about how much they're putting in, but also how much they are dispersing on the ground, how and where they're dispersing it, and which partnerships they're establishing. It's up to international organizations and advocacy groups to really hold those donors to account, to make sure that we are clarifying those pledges and making sure that donors are following through on those promises. And then, as you said, it's also up to country governments themselves to really focus on making sure those resources are well spent, to make sure that they are sort of owning and leading the response on the ground. As we've also seen, there's heroic work being done by citizens in all three of the most heavily affected countries to really follow the money, to help deliver resources, and to do that transparently and accountably. So unless all of those players come together and help build a new, more modern system for tracking, we're going to repeat some of the same mistakes that we've been making in past crises as well.
And in mentioning some of the past crises, for instance, the tsunami in 2004, as well as the earthquake in Haiti, what were some of the problems that were created because of a lack of accountability?
I think particularly in the case of Haiti, you know, we've actually seen a number of pieces written in recent weeks and months about this. We still can't get a full accounting for what resources were pledged. Were they spent? How were they spent? Did they go to support Haitians or did they go to support big NGOs? And I think, you know, in the end, we're still not able to create a clear verdict on how we did in that crisis and to really learn lessons from that. And colleagues of ours who have studied this, particularly in Haiti, really still say it's a mess and a bit of a broken system where there's no way for advocates to clearly hold donors to account because we still don't have clear streams of information that help us paint the full picture.
So then to change, as you put it, this broken system in the future, because there will be another crisis coming up, what needs to be done? What would be the first step?
From our perspective, it's a two-step process. We both need to create a better information platform where we can assess and monitor what donors are giving, not just in terms of cash, but also in terms of the many other types of inputs that we talked about earlier, in-kind contributions, healthcare personnel. Finding a way to build and track those commitments is really critical. And making sure we have clear definitions for what counts and what doesn't, making sure we've actually got human capacity to hold those donors to account when they're putting in bad information, that's all essential. But that leads me to the second part of the equation, which is that donors also have a key role to play in this. They've got to commit the time and political will to making sure that any new tracking system we create really has the buy-in from their governments, and that they're committed to making commitments that are transparent, that are clear, and really delivered on in the end.
Erin Hohlfelder is the Global Health Policy Director for the One Campaign. She spoke with me from Washington.
Ethiopian authorities have released five bloggers and journalists after more than a year in prison, but four others remain behind bars. Mohamed Yusuf reports their release yesterday comes before a visit to Ethiopia later this month by U.S. President Barack Obama.
Media rights group and legal practitioners have welcomed the decision of the Ethiopian government prosecutor to drop terrorism charges against some of the detained journalists and bloggers. The blogger's lawyer, Ameha Makonnen, says the ruling raises more questions and urge authorities to apply the law equally to all the accused.
We accepted the decision. In fact, there are lots of questions to raise. For instance, why the other bloggers are not released. There is no reason for others not to be released, as long as the prosecution is convinced that three of the journalists and two of the bloggers should be released. So we don't see any other reason not to release the others.
Four other people from the blogging collective known as Zone 9 remain in jail. The bloggers have been writing mostly social and political issues critical of the government. Authorities have accused the bloggers of planning terrorist attacks and colluding with US-based opposition group Ginbot 7, which Ethiopia considers a terrorist organization. The Committee to Protect Journalists East Africa representative, Tom Rhodes, says the organization welcomes the move by Ethiopian officials, but is still concerned about the remaining bloggers and journalists.
I'm also very, very concerned for the journalists who still remain in jail. I mean, we're talking about Defekadu, Atnaf, Abel, and Natnail. According to news reports at the moment, they're saying that these guys are the so-called masterminds and the others were simply accomplices. So I fear that it may be a long haul before these remaining four finally get the justice they deserve and are released.
The Committee to Protect Journalists said at least 12 other journalists are still imprisoned, most facing terrorism charges, which makes Ethiopia the second worst place for journalists to work in Africa, after neighbouring Eritrea. U.S. President Barack Obama is expected to visit Ethiopia later this month as part of an Africa visit that includes a trip to Kenya, where he will participate in a global entrepreneurship summit. In Ethiopia, Mr. Obama is expected to meet the country's top officials and hold a separate meeting with African Union leaders. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Douglas Simpoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. South Sudan marks its fourth anniversary today, but there is little to celebrate. Ethiopian authorities release five bloggers and a journalist after more than a year in prison, but four others remain behind bars. And thousands of migrants and refugees are reported stranded at the border between Greece and Macedonia. Coming up, we'll have music from Liberia, and in our feature segment, the United States, Britain, and Sweden are providing millions for the Zimbabwe Works Project. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehias Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Thursday, Sunny.
Happy Thursday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I hear that you are beginning today with Wimbledon tennis.
Kim, my opening serve on the Sunny Side of Sports is once again Wimbledon tennis. And joining us with a Thursday update is VOA's Jonah Haskell. Sporting greetings, Jonah.
Sporty greetings, Sonny. Top-ranked Serena Williams will play Spain's Garbiñe Muguruza in Saturday's final at the prestigious grass court tournament. The first semifinal Thursday, Muguruza defeated Agnieszka Radwańska in Poland in three sets, 6-2, 6-3, 6-3. Radwańska, who is ranked 13th in the world, had reached the finals of Wimbledon once before in 2012, while Muguruza, ranked 20th, had never advanced past the quarterfinals of a major before. As thrilled as she may be to have reached the final, Muguruza will now have the unenviable task of playing world number one Serena Williams, who ousted Maria Sharapova of Russia in straight sets, 6-2, 6-4. As a 17-year-old, Sharapova beat Serena in the 2004 Wimbledon final, but has not defeated Williams since, a streak of what is now 17 consecutive matches between them. Serena also beat Sharapova in this year's Australian Open final. If Serena can win her sixth Wimbledon title on Saturday, she will be set up to win the Grand Slam with a triumph at the U.S. Open in September. The men's semifinals will take place on Friday in London and should be a great watch as world number one Novak Djokovic takes on surprise semifinalist Richard Gasquet. The Frenchman Gasquet, seeded 20th, is crashing a party of the world's top seeds after beating world number four and 2015 French Open champ Stan Wawrinka in the quarters. Djokovic has already been in some trouble playing against low seeds in this tournament, needing five sets and a second-day restart to dispatch of South Africa's Kevin Anderson in the round of 16. In the other semifinal, world number three Andy Murray, the 2013 Wimbledon champion, will take on world number two Roger Federer. Murray made it to the final of the Australian Open this year before losing to Djokovic and then lost to the Joker again in the semifinals of the French Open in June. He'll definitely be looking for another shot at Djokovic in the final. Meanwhile, Federer, on the other hand, has not had a great year at majors, having not made it past the quarterfinals until Wimbledon. Nevertheless, Roger says that he's feeling great in the lead-up to the match.
Like you said, I'm very happy to be in the semis again. The road is long getting here, but still I feel like I'm fresh and I've got energy left in the tank for hopefully a great match with Andy, and then we'll see, but I'm looking forward to it.
Federer and Murray have some recent history at Wimbledon. They faced each other in the 2012 final, which Federer won in four sets. Federer should feel at home playing in an important match at Wimbledon. He's won the tournament seven times, and with the win this year would set a new record for the most Wimbledon titles ever. With your Thursday Wimbledon update, I'm VOA's Jonah Haskell. Back to you, Sonny.
Thanks, Jonah. World football's governing body, FIFA, released its latest set of monthly rankings on Thursday, and there was a change at the very top. Argentina moved past Belgium and Germany to take the number one spot in the world rankings for the first time in 7 years. The Germans dropped one place to number two, and the Belgians are at number three. Argentina, led by superstar Lionel Messi, achieved the number one ranking after losing to host Chile on penalty kicks in the final of the recent Copa America tournament. Meanwhile, newly crowned South American champion Chile moved up eight positions, just missing out on a top 10 ranking at number 11. So let's take a quick look now at FIFA's top 10 teams. Argentina, Germany, and Belgium are 1, 2, and 3. Colombia is 4th, the Netherlands is 5th, and Brazil is 6th. Portugal, Romania, England, and Wales round out the top 10. Looking at the top 10 African teams in the July FIFA rankings, the Desert Foxes of Algeria remain number one on the continent and 19th overall. The Elephants of Ivory Coast, the reigning African champions, are second on the continent and 21st overall. The Black Stars of Ghana are third in Africa and 25th overall. Rounding out the top 10 African teams, we have Tunisia at 32, Senegal at 39, Cameroon at 42, Congo-Brazzaville at 47, the Cape Verde Islands at 52, Egypt at 55, and Nigeria at 57th overall. In African club football, action resumes this coming weekend in both the CAF Champions League and CAF Confederations Cup tournaments. African football guru David Legg looks at the upcoming fixtures, beginning with the Champions League.
On Friday, you got USM Alger against El Merrekh. Now, these are two sides who won their opening matches in Group B. USM, they shocked the defending champion Sétif on their own ground by 2-1. And Merrekh had a routine 2-0 win over Ulma of Algeria. So a really interesting top-of-the-table tie there, Sonny, and I think the fact that the Algerians have got home advantage probably gives them a slight edge. On the Saturday, you've got a clash of great importance now between Ulma and Sétif. This is an all-Algerian clash. A reminder to our listeners, three Algerian clubs in one group, which is competed by Merrekh of Sudan. Ulma and Sétif, they both lost their opening matches. Sétif really surprisingly going down at home to Ulma. So points are absolutely critical for both sides. Despite the fact that they're playing away, I would give a slight nod towards Sétif because I think they realize, Sonny, that a second consecutive defeat could really spell dire danger for them. The prospect of them not qualifying for the semi-finals and surrendering the title. There were also surprises in Group A, and on Sunday, we have the match day two fixtures, which are Maghreb Tetouan of Morocco at home to TP Mazembe of DR Congo, and El Hilal of Sudan at home to Smouha of Egypt. Let's look at Tetouan and Mazembe first. Now, Mazembe, I happened to see on TV their match against El Hilal, which ended in a goalless draw, and Mazembe were really disappointing. I mean, this is a side that has been assembled from the stars of Tanzania, Zambia, Mali, Ghana, and Democratic Republic of Congo itself. And they were the co-favorites to win the competition after the qualifiers with Sétif. But Sétif losing at home and Mazembe failing to score at home and being held to a draw. So not a good start for the co-favorite. Tetouan, on the other hand, they threw away a 2-goal lead. 2 up at halftime against Smouha in Egypt, but they ended up 3-2 losers. And more trouble for them could be the reported loss of their star striker, Ayajur. He's reported to be on his way to Qatar. And he would be a big blow because he's the joint leading scorer at the moment with 6 goals. With home advantage, Sonny, I think Tetouan could add to the problems of Mazembe by winning this match. While Mazembe disappointed in Lubumbashi, their opponents, El Hilal of Sudan, were impressive. And in fact, it took a couple of late saves from the veteran Kidiaba to stop the Sudanese from snatching a shock away victory. And on that basis, they must be slight favourites, despite the fact that Smouha come to Khartoum buoyant indeed. Buoyant because, having been 2 goals behind, they came back to win 3-2 against Tetouan. So really interesting matches, Sonny, and I think eyes particularly on Mazembe and on Sétif, the co-favorites. One loss, the other drew. If they were both to lose, they would be in serious trouble just two match days into the CAF Champions League.
David, let's turn now to the CAF Confederation Cup. And how about a look at those fixtures?
Right, Sonny, and two losers clash on Friday in the first match of the weekend. It's in Group B, and it's between Sfaxien of Tunisia and Leopards of Congo Brazzaville. That match will be played in Sfax, which is on the east coast of Tunisia. And the fact that both teams lost their first match, Sfaxien away to Zamalek of Egypt and Leopards at home to Orlando Pirates of South Africa, gives this match great significance. Because you dare not lose your first two matches. If other clubs are to win, it means that they could have an early six-point advantage, and that's an awful lot of leeway to make up. What is interesting about this tie, Sonny, is that previously Leopards have gone to Sfax, which is a real fortress. It's a city on the Mediterranean coast, and they won there by 2-0. But I don't see Lightning striking twice, and I think Sfaxien will bounce back and win that game. Moving on to Saturday, we've got two fixtures. We've got Orlando Pirates against Zamalek. Now, this is a repeat of a Champions League game of two seasons back when the South Africans hammered the Egyptians by 4-1. I do not see a repeat of that scoreline. I think it's going to be a lot closer. Zamalek have improved, but Pirates are also looking good. Impressive 1-0 winners over Leopards in Congo Brazzaville on what was described as a cabbage patch pitch. And on the basis that they've got home advantage, Sonny, I'm giving a slight advantage to Pirates. I think they can squeeze home, perhaps by the odd goal. The other match on Saturday is a Tunisian derby between Esperance and Etoile Sportive du Sahel. Sahel started with a 1-0 home victory over Stade Malien of Mali, but Esperance got a 3-0 drubbing away to Al Ahly of Egypt. So they've got a lot of catching up to do. Esperance don't seem to be in particularly good form, but the fact that they need desperately these 3 points might just inspire them to victory. And last, but certainly not least, and the only Sunday fixture, it's Stade Malien of Mali is home to Al Ahly of Egypt. Now, just how good are Al Ahly? They looked very impressive against Esperance in winning 3-0, with two of the goals coming from Abdallah Saeed, who the coach, Fatih Mabrouk, said is an exceptional, awesome player. But there is one if about this victory, Sonny, and that is if Esperance were at full strength, would it have been 3-0? The Esperance team were, in fact, short of six first-choice players. Now, the real test for the Al Ahly side is going to come in Bamako against Stade Malien, because Egyptian sides, for all their strength at home, often struggle in sub-Saharan Africa. They do not enjoy the conditions of playing in a place like Bamako, where the crowd can be hostile and perhaps everything doesn't go according to plan. Malien, on the other hand, they lost their first match. This is a home game. They know they now need 3 points. So, really interesting fixture, Sonny, in the Confederation Cup. I think what I'll be watching in particular is that performance of Al Ahly to see if that first result can be borne out in its strength by the fact that they can now go to Mali and also win there.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny, and thank you, Jonah and Toddy. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, trying to overcome the rise of homegrown radical Islam in France. And next, United States, Britain, and Sweden providing millions for the Zimbabwe Works Project. But first, some music. Here is Nimba Burr from Liberia with Ikandorba. Nober, Liberia, Witty Kandoba.
Yes, nice song, Yehias. While threatened by terrorist attacks from within its borders, the French government rushes to reinforce public tolerance. A key is encouraging the nation's historic secularism and a more secular civic style among imams and other key Muslim figures. Can this overcome the rise of homegrown radical Islam? Lisa Bryant takes a look at one training program in the French city of Lyon.
Dans le Nouveau Testament, à travers non plus un événement de libération.
A religion class at the Catholic University of Lyon, the lecture is on the Bible. But the dozen or so students jotting down notes are not aspiring priests. One is a woman wearing a headscarf. A man sports the beard of a devout Muslim. Still others are non-Muslims, civil servants working for the local government. Together, they're on the front lines of a national drive for greater religious tolerance and to shape a moderate Islam à la française.
Comment faire pour passer l'enseignement pour qu'on ne dise pas que...
This class is part of a university-level training program run jointly by two Lyon universities and the city's main mosque. It includes classes on law, religion, and how French principles of secularism are applied to daily life. Students visit churches, mosques, and synagogues to learn more about France's main faith. At the end of the 24-week program, they get certificates in the understanding of secularity. Since it was launched just over 2 years ago, the program has already trained several dozen imams, Muslim chaplains, and teachers, along with many non-Muslim civil servants. Michel Younes oversees a training program at the Catholic University.
Et l'intuition, c'était de dire, si on veut que les choses bougent, il faut qu'elles bougent.
Younes says that by bringing Muslim leaders and civil servants together, the program aims to overcome differences in a society where public displays of religiosity are almost considered taboo. France has always had an uneasy relationship with Islam, the country's second biggest religion. Issues like wearing headscarves in public schools, now banned in France, to halal butchering practices in Muslim burial grounds, have deepened misunderstandings and divisions. It doesn't help that many imams in France are foreigners. Few French Muslims are interested in taking a job so badly paid, and sometimes not paid at all. So the imams come from North Africa and Turkey, countries which cover their salaries and sometimes finance the construction of the French mosque they preach from. Some can't speak French. Many only have a sketchy idea of French society and laws. Hassan Taibi, who heads the Islamic studies program at Lyon's main mosque, says these imported imams don't fit the needs of Muslims here today.
Mais aujourd'hui, il y a des musulmans qui sont issus de la deuxième, troisième génération d'immigration, qui comprennent pas l'arabe du tout.
Taibi says many Muslims in France are second and third generation immigrants. They don't understand the Arabic preachings of the foreign imams. The clerics come from another culture, he says, and sometimes French mosque-goers won't accept them. So the imams enroll in language classes and the civics training program in Lyon that this mosque helps to organize. But the secularism classes have another goal, to help counter the rise of homegrown radical Islam. Over the past 2 years, hundreds of French have joined Islamist fighters in the Middle East. French Islamists have also staged attacks at home, most recently in January, when three men gunned down 17 people in Paris. To be sure, only a tiny percentage of the country's 5 million strong Muslim community are extremists. A number of extremists are in fact recent converts who learned about Islam on the internet. Today, the socialist government wants to shape the way Islam is taught here to ensure a moderate version is spread that aligns with French values. Across the country, there are now half a dozen civics courses like the one in Lyon. Authorities want to double that number. They want to enroll hundreds of imams in these programs and make them mandatory for chaplains working in prisons or the military.
Les auteurs l'appréhendent, la comprennent. J'en ai parlé tout à l'heure.
At the Bible class, student Karim Hanemi says he's enjoyed learning about Christianity and Judaism, religions he knew very little about. Khanemi is vice president of a religious association managing a small mosque in Lyon.
En ce qui concerne les cours de droit, eh ben, les cours de droit, ils ont l'avantage souvent de...
Khanemi says the program has also told him that French laws on secularism are surprisingly open. Practices he thought were forbidden, like circumcision, are in fact tolerated, although female circumcision is not. This understanding can help fight extremism, he says, by countering the sense among some Muslims that they're oppressed in France. But some question whether the secularism courses or the imams who take them can really make a difference. Tariq Oubrou is rector and imam of the main mosque in Bordeaux. He's written and spoken extensively about Islam in France.
Vous savez le travail des imams, ils ont désamorcé des milliers de bombes, mais on n'en parle pas.
Oubrou says that in many mosques, imams speak out against violence. He says their prevention work has helped dismantle thousands of ticking bombs or radical attacks. But he says most would-be jihadists stay away from mosques. They're hoodlums who don't even say their prayers on a regular basis. Imams can't fix a problem that society, not religion, has created. If nothing else, the secularism classes are building bonds. At the Bible class, Laurent Jacquelin, a senior official for the regional prefecture, says the training has opened his eyes to another slice of French society.
Ce qui est singulier donc dans cette formation, c'est effectivement qu'on rencontre des personnes d'horizons très.
He says the civil servants and the Muslim clerics discuss ideas and share meals. It's a chance to strengthen what brings them together, and not what sets them apart. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Lyon, France.
United States, Britain and Sweden have provided $8 million for the second phase of the Zimbabwe Works project to provide technical, vocational and entrepreneurship skills to 22,500 young people in the next 3 years. Erwin Chifera of VOA Zimbabwe Service has the report.
This follows the successful completion of phase one of the project, which ran from 2012 to 2014 and benefited 8,600 young Zimbabweans. It was funded by the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID. The objective of the ZimWorks project is to improve the economic prospects of young people in 11 urban and rural districts nationwide. The program provides mentorship and internships opportunities for youth and business development services for job seekers. Zimbabwe USAID Mission Director Stefan Funk said, despite the challenges and difficulties the country faces, there is tremendous potential for young people in the country.
Young entrepreneurs are turning the wheels, and from where I stand, they are determined to build their own future. ZimWorks is here to support them in keeping that wheel turning and building the momentum.
ZimWorks Phase 1 beneficiary, 27-year-old Simbarashi Nyamadzao, says without the training he received under the program, he would not be the successful motivational speaker, author and employer he is today.
I've benefited in a huge way. It became a turning point in my life in the sense that it accelerated my progress. Just after the training program, I went on to implement the skills which I learned, which are mainly networking, persistence and opportunity seeking. Within 6 weeks of that, I went on to do business with 7 people in my class. 6 months down the line, I had my first TV interview and I began to gain relevance on radio, press.
Another beneficiary, 23-year-old banking and finance graduate Lisa Mashaka, has started a small catering company thanks to the ZimWorks project.
So I benefited exposure, networking, how to handle business, how to be an entrepreneur, how to manage your finances. Because I had initially stepped down, or not stepped down as such, but I initially stopped because of economic constraints. But now that I know how to manage, even in the economy, I have started again.
United Kingdom Department for International Development head in Zimbabwe, Annabel Gary, said, while young women are more likely to remain unemployed, the program would provide them with skills, confidence, and economic opportunities. Small and Medium Enterprises Minister Stembisonyoni commended the US, Britain, and Sweden for financing the program, which is being implemented at a time when the country is facing serious unemployment challenges. Reporting from Harare, this is Ivan Chifera.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up with this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Huhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Defeating ISIL will take time and a unified global effort and can be done, said President Barack Obama.
This is a long-term campaign. ISIL is opportunistic and it is nimble. In many places in Syria and Iraq, including urban areas, it's dug in among innocent civilian populations. It will take time to root them out. And doing so must be the job of local forces on the ground with training and air support from our coalition.
On the military front, the U.S.-led coalition of some 60 nations, including Arab partners, has hit ISIL with more than 5,000 airstrikes, taking out thousands of fighting positions, tanks, and training camps, and eliminating thousands of fighters. ISIL has lost more than a quarter of the populated areas it had seized in Iraq and recently endured losses across northern Syria. ISIL's losses show that its strategic weaknesses are real, said President Obama. ISIL is surrounded by countries and communities committed to its destruction. It is backed by no nation. Its unrestrained brutality often alienates those under its rule, creating new enemies. But ISIL's reign of terror will end only when the military force against it is matched by a broader effort, political and economic, that addresses the underlying conditions that have allowed ISIL to gain traction, Mr. Obama said. In Iraq, that includes rebuilding security and helping Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi forge an inclusive government that unites all Iraqis. In Syria, it means establishing a political transition to a new government without Bashar al-Assad that serves all Syrians. President Obama noted that the ISIL threat has extended beyond Iraq and Syria, and that defeating its destructive ideology cannot rely simply on a military effort, but must ultimately be defeated by better ideas, more attractive and more compelling vision. The larger battle for hearts and minds is a generational struggle to be won by the countries and communities that terrorists like ISIL target. It's going to be up to Muslim communities to keep rejecting warped interpretations of Islam, said Mr. Obama, to all people to reject the sectarianism that so often fuels resentments and conflicts, to governments to address the political and economic grievances that terrorists exploit, to nations that empower citizens to decide their own destiny and that uphold human rights for all their people. Those can be powerful antidotes to extremist ideologies, said President Obama. Those are the countries that will find a true partner in the United States.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.